Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from Volume 61, Number 1, the Fall 2021 issue of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine. It's called Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies, and Triumphs. And the first article today is My Journey to Change Education in America, an interview with Dorothy Counts Scroggins by the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine team. And we begin with a special note from the team, Words Matter. Words matter. Language inspires, and some expressions cause pain. We know that a primary source, like a letter, photograph, or diary entry, is created at the time of an event, and is recorded later by a person with firsthand experience of it. This article, an interview in a question and answer format, is a primary source of an event that Dorothy Counts Scroggins experienced when she was 15 years old and the first black student to attend Harry P. Harding High School more than 50 years ago. She shares how some white people were hateful to her because they did not want any black students to go to the school they attended, and they used hateful words and more to express themselves. Count Scroggins tells of one racial slur, an insult based on someone's race or ethnicity that people shouted at her that day. The word hurt her then, and it remains an extremely cruel word today. Despite the viciousness vented toward her, young Dorothy Counts calmly and proudly entered the school. Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine's editorial staff spoke with experts and educators about using an even partially spelled version of the highly offensive word. However, we recognize that editing the word out of the article completely would diminish the power and truth of Count Scroggins' experience. We also know that primary sources require a framework for understanding and learning. It is our expectation that this article provides background for the recounting of this significant event that resonates today while maintaining accuracy to her experience. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court declared racial segregation, which is the practice or policy of keeping people of different races, religions, etc., separate from one another, racial segregation of public schools was unconstitutional. In theory, this meant that all states would have to enroll black students at all white public schools. School districts in southern states, including North Carolina, largely ignored the decision. Segregation continued. 3 years later, a group of African American parents in Charlotte tested desegregation efforts by applying for their children to attend white schools. As a result of this effort, 15-year-old Dorothy Counts became the first African American student to integrate Harry P. Harding High School on September 4, 1957. Her simple presence at the school enraged white parents. Together with their children, they mobbed Dorothy on her front walk to Harding's front doors. They shouted deeply hurtful racial slurs and spit on the beautiful blue and yellow plaid dress her grandmother had made for her the first day of school. A photographer captured the scene, and images of twisted and mocking white faces were reprinted around the world, strengthening the movement for school integration. Dorothy Counts Scroggins, now 79 years old and still a resident of Charlotte, very kindly agreed to be interviewed by the Tar Heel Junior Historian staff to share her story. Question: How did your parents become involved in this effort? Did they talk with you about the possibility of going to Harding High and what that would symbolize? Counts Scroggins: Our family was approached by the late Kelly Alexander, president of the local chapter of the NAACP, to be one of the families to test the Charlotte school system after the 1954 school Supreme Court ruling. My parents were well respected as community leaders, especially my father, a minister and college professor at Johnson C. Smith University. We talked more about why going to Harding was morally right than the negatives. There were signs foreshadowing a difficult journey for me, threats, phone calls, but I knew nothing of them. My parents wanted to protect me from the immoral stupidity of a bigoted society. From my mother's support and my father's prayers, I gained the power and confidence needed to embark on the most significant journey of my lifetime. Question. I think all of us know the first day of school jitters well, but your first day at Harding was drastically different from what most of us face today. Were you fearful or anxious? What advice or words of support did your parents give you to help you prepare? Count Scoggins. Yes, anxious, because it was a new school and I did not have my friends or my brother with me. But I knew I could do this. My father's friend and colleague, Dr. Edwin Tompkins, came that morning to be supportive of me. My father asked that he ride with us, and he was not sure of what to expect at the school that morning. As we did each morning, eating breakfast together and prayer, my father asked for my safety during the day. My mother gave me a big hug and assured me that everything would be fine. As we approached the school, we witnessed the crowds of students and adults that lined the street and saw that the entrance to the school was barricaded by the police. I knew then that I would have to walk through the crowd of protesters to get to the front door of the auditorium. That was when I realized they were there to keep me out, and I knew then that I had to make that walk of faith. My father said to me, "Remember that you are inferior to no one, and hold your head up high. And you can do anything that you want to do, and no one can stand in your way." That was all I needed as I made the two-block walk to Harding that morning. I would not let a mob of students and adults keep me from getting the same education that they were receiving. Question. An angry mob of white adults and children waited for you at the school and harassed you on your walk to the doors. What kind of things were they saying and doing? Count Scoggins. As I approached the crowd of hundreds of protesters, including students and adults, that morning, I was in awe that I would be denied the opportunity to pursue the education that I so desired, but was also entitled to as an American citizen. I remember the words of my father that morning, "You can do anything that you want to do, and no one can stand in your way." Determination prevented me from breaking down in front of students and adults, hurling hateful cries of the N-word and shouting, "Go back to Africa, and we do not want you here." While sticks, rocks, ice, and other debris were thrown at me, I was pushed and shoved during the walk. Female students were told by an adult to spit on her, which is the most humiliating thing that any individual could experience. My thoughts were, who but a coward would spit on a child and then deny them the right to an education simply because of the color of their skin? But through all of this, pride illuminated from my face as I carried myself with dignity when met with such hatred and humiliation. Question. Photographs show you with your head held high, striking a determined but peaceful posture. How did you find the strength to stand tall in the face of such bullying and harassment? Count Scoggins. How do you find the strength to do anything? Determination. I continued to walk with dignity, remembering that I was not alone. I carried the love and support of my family in the African-American community. I truly believed that I was doing what was right, and that I was inferior to no one. The intensity of those beliefs drowned out the pain of the despicable insults that encircled me, enabling me to continue my journey as I held my head up with pride, as the spit dripped from the hem of my dress. Question: how did school teachers and officials respond? Did they provide any protection or take any measures to ensure that you had the same opportunity to learn as white students? Count Scoggins: this is where the hurt came for me. I had been taught all my life to respect adults, and I had a love for the field of education, as I had a generation of family members that were in education and were good examples for us growing up. Inside Harding was not any different. I was ignored by teachers and administrators while tucked away in the back of the classroom. It was very clear that they were not acknowledging my existence. I wanted them to know that I was prepared to participate, eager to learn, and ready to share priceless lessons that only I could share. They ignored me. My efforts were in vain, and my contributions were discounted. Question: you continued to attend classes at Harding for 3 more days before your parents withdrew you. What was the turning point that caused them to move you to a different school? Count Scoggins: my peers continued to push and shove me in the halls, stairwells, and on the walkways, and also disrespected me while eating lunch by spitting in my food. I suffered through 3 brutal and agonizing days. I was reminded every minute of every day that I was not wanted, but I never hung my head and was never afraid. On my 4th day, I was hit in the back of my head with a sharp object and a blackboard eraser in the middle of my back before leaving school for lunch. When I walked outside, I stared at the shattered window of my parents' car with my older brother, Herman, sitting inside. My mistreatment was one thing, but proving to small-minded extremists that I had the right to an education was not worth endangering my family. My parents felt that I had endured enough and that I was not being allowed to get the education that I desired, so my father called family and close friends together to share a decision that we had made. I, like every child, had the desire to belong. It took a great deal of strength for me to admit that I had reached the end of that journey, departing with the entire world watching and waiting for the slightest sign of failure. I was trusting of others, that they would see the individual that I was. But I realized I was ahead of my time. The white community was not ready for me. They were neither prepared nor willing to make the concessions that unity and solidarity demanded. Question: in the decades since your experience at Harding High, you have dedicated yourself to improving and advancing educational opportunities for children. What do you want young people to know about the importance of knowledge, of kindness, and of treating each other with respect? Count Scoggins: now, 64 years later, I do feel that my journey was not in vain. I paved the way during this era for other young people to achieve that which I so desired. The journey continues, but the lesson I learned personally is that it prepared me to be an advocate for those who do not have a voice. As I reflect on these days, I never felt anything but remorse for my peers. I cannot fault them for what they had been taught. I realized that our teachings had been different. I grew up in a community where we were taught love. They were taught hatred. I was taught acceptance. They were taught intolerance. I was taught to forgive. They were taught to retaliate. I was taught respect. They were taught to ridicule and stigmatize. This was the beginning of another journey for me. I vowed that I would work to make sure that what happened to me would not happen to another child. This experience of not being accepted, of being judged, scorned, harassed, and ridiculed, has shaped my thoughts, has shaped my attitudes, and has shaped my choices. This has made me the person I am today, a defender of acceptance and a champion of change. I have dedicated my life to working to enrich the lives of others and organizations of organizations in which to ultimately create a more just and caring world. After my experience with the desegregation of schools in Charlotte, I chose a life to ensure that all children would receive a quality education regardless of their race, religion, and culture. In addition, to be free from injustice and to learn to live in a diverse world and be accepting of others. Question: what final words of advice do you have for the youngest generation now coming up? Count Scoggins. I would say to each of them, people in this country have made sacrifices and even lost lives for you to have a quality education and opportunities that they did not have. Now it is your time to pick up the torch and carry it forward. You cannot make it in this world with just a high school education. Learning is a tool to be successful. There are many options for you, more than I had. I want you to be a leader and not a follower. Show me that what I did made a difference, and that you will make me proud. Here are the captions to the photographs that accompany this article. 15-year-old Dorothy Counts walks to school on her first day at Harry P. Harding High School in Charlotte on September 4, 1957, amid jeers from adults and other students opposed to integration. To the right of her is family friend Dr. Edwin Tompkins. The photo, by Douglas Martin of Associated Press, was seen around the world and was winner of the 1957 World Press Photo of the Year. On May 31, 2019, Dorothy Counts Scoggins, the first black student to integrate Harding P. High School, returned to her old school, now Irwin Academic Center. This time she received a very different reception. She was welcomed as a hero by students and faculty with hugs, posters, and cheers. Count Scoggins was escorted by Girl Scout Troop 569 members Morgan Winston and Maya McLean. Next up, the winner of the Intermediate Division of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest. The article is The Resilience of John Coltrane by Alex Pell, who, as a member of the Jesse Franklin Pioneers, Mount Airy Museum of Regional History in Mount Airy, Justin Kissam advisor, Alex was the winner of the 2021 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest Intermediate Division. The sweet sounds of jazz are indicative of many a great musician, none more so than John Coltrane. Born of humble beginnings, he would go on to achieve fame and influence generations of musicians in his lifetime and beyond, but not without strife in the form of death, addiction, discrimination, and critics. This is the story of John Coltrane and resilience. Coltrane was born in Hamlet on September 23, 1926, and his family soon moved to High Point. His family was very religious, and both his father and grandfather were preachers. Around this time, he also became acquainted with gospel music, which left an imprint on him going into adulthood. When he turned 12, tragedy struck, and both his father and grandfather passed. To remove himself from the sad and depressive state he was in, he took to playing the clarinet. While attending William Penn High School in High Point, he played the clarinet in local bands, but eventually made the switch to the saxophone. After this period of time, he decided that he would join the Navy. On August 6, 1945, Coltrane was enlisted into the Navy and was sent to the Naval Training Station at Sampson in upstate New York, which was separated based on race from white soldiers. By the time he finished his training, World War II was over. Following his discharge from the Navy, he made his way back to Philadelphia, where he was met by a fresh jazz scene that Coltrane integrated himself into, making use of the GI Bill to take music courses. Playing his saxophone at any time he possibly could, he began to gain a following, and larger music groups began to take notice of him. Soon after, he made the switch to the tenor saxophone, From 1946 to 1955, Coltrane was always waiting to be hired for his next gig. It was during this time that he developed an addiction to heroin, which he was addicted to for the following 6 years. In the summer of 1955, trumpeter Miles Davis brought Coltrane to New York, which brought him immense amounts of fame. By the time the 1960s came around, Coltrane had become one of the most famous musicians of the time, with very high pay. In his most well-known album, A Love Supreme, 1965, he wrote in the liner notes, "During the year 1957, I experienced, by the grace of God, a spiritual awakening which was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life." This shows how Coltrane's spiritual awakening affected him and his lifestyle and led him on his journey to sobriety. After he worked with Miles Davis, he met a man named Thelonious Monk, which led him to even more musical prowess. This was also the point where Coltrane was criticized and put down by the music industry. In 1961, Coltrane formed the Classic Quartet with members McCoy Tyner on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums. As time progressed, Coltrane's music became further and further from the mainstream. He remained busy recording Ascension in 1965 and Om in 1967. These albums ignore many of the common tropes in music, giving the musicians the freedom to play whatever they wanted. With this expansion also came the abrasive opinions of these records from critics, as they were not conforming to the common sound that was coming from jazz. Coltrane's earlier addictions to alcohol and heroin eventually took a large toll on his life, despite being sober. Because of this, he suffered liver failure in July of 1967 and died at the age of 40. Coltrane's musical improvisations came close to the intensity of religious testimony in the eyes of most. With the civil rights movement, he abandoned all the stereotypes of music at the time to free himself musically with more emotionally charged performances. These performances took a lot from the aesthetic and technicality of traditional religious practices, as well as the spiritual purpose of religion. These improvisations also broke through racial stereotypes of the time. Though many disapproved of him, he continued still to play however he wanted to. He protested racial discrimination and disapproval by expressing his feelings no matter how he was perceived. There is power in music, which John Coltrane demonstrates very well. With his music, he was able to move people and touch their hearts. When it comes to people who want to learn more about music or really anything, he gives this advice: if there's something you don't understand, you have to go humbly to it. You don't go to school and sit down and say, "I know what you're getting ready to teach me," you know. You sit there and you learn. You open your mind. You absorb. Here are the captions with a couple of photographs that are accompanying this article. Michelle Coltrane reaches up to touch a historical marker dedicated in honor of her stepfather, legendary jazz great John Coltrane, that was unveiled at his childhood home of 118 Underhill Street in High Point on August 30th, 2019. And North Carolina native John Coltrane, 1926 born, 1967 died, jazz composer and saxophonist, was honored on a United States postage stamp in 1995. The next article is from the editor, Kathy East. What do you think? Wow, we've covered a lot of history in this issue. From colonial times to modern times. The history that you are living through right now. We've learned that tough times can be challenging, they can be scary, they can make us sad or even mad, but we've also learned about real people who kept going and found resilience. Research shows that going through tough times can actually help us develop more empathy for others. What does empathy mean? It sounds a lot like sympathy, but it's not the same. Sympathy means feeling sad or sorry for someone when something bad happens to them. But empathy means more. It's the ability to actually feel what another person is feeling, to understand and share their experiences and emotions. empathy can help understand, can help us understand each other better. And that can bring us closer together to make our communities stronger and more resilient. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many people put up encouraging signs on their front doors and their cars, in the windows of businesses and schools. See the sign in the photo above? It says, "Stay safe, stay healthy, and be kind." When COVID shut down movie theaters and other businesses, the historic Rialto Theater in Raleigh did not just go dark. The owners and staff decided to use their marquee to share fun or hopeful messages with the community. I often couldn't wait to see what new message they would put up next. We hope life will be back to normal soon. Still then, stay safe, stay healthy, be kind. We are Tar Heels. We are resilient. Our history reminds us that we will get through this together. And here are the captions of the photographs accompanying this. The historic Rialto Theater in Raleigh has welcomed moviegoers for decades. When COVID-19 closed theaters, the Rialto helped cheer up neighbors and passers-by with messages of hope and humor. Despite COVID-19, many junior historians continued to work on contest projects for the Tar Heel Junior History Association annual convention, like Grace Gibson of the Greenfield Tar Heel Junior Historians. During hard times, we need our friends even more. Adam Stutz and Femi Oyejide masked up, bundled up, and met outside to play pickleball to help keep their rivalry and friendship going. And going to school by staying home was a challenge. Oliver Pratt, like many kids, found creative ways to carve out a spot for learning with the help of his study buddy, Spaghetti Dog Pratt. And here's one story from our collection. It's about an iron lung from 1945 to 1950. Polio is a virus that can cause weakness or paralysis of muscle groups in the legs. When it affected the chest, it could also affect breathing. Machines like this one, first known as the drinker respirator and later as the iron lung, could provide breathing support for patients until their health improved and they could breathe on their own again. The patient would lie with their body inside the machine with the head outside. See opening at left. The windows allowed doctors and nurses to check on the patients and tend to their needs. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available after the podcast, as a podcast after the broadcast, on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.